The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. And right over here, this is John Barber. That was Sarita singing once again, Sunny, with the great Joe Pass Trio. And that was the speaking voice of Frank Sinatra, probably, except for the Beatles, the greatest pop musical performer of the last 100 years, the greatest influence. He was introducing me on The Tonight Show. And once again, this is I, John Barber, from John Barber's World, right here in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's October 19th, 2015. It is an absolutely wonderful day after 90 days of over 100 degree heat. It is beautiful here with two wonderful, eye-opening, mind-expanding guests. Like most of you, I like to try to start my day with a hot coffee. And it used to be Starbucks. It's a good coffee, but I found out it's a better laxative, and I don't need that. So, and also, the thing is, if you take two sips of Starbucks coffee, it is cold. So what I do now, and I would suggest to you, I would go to McDonald's. They make a really good, inexpensive coffee, and it stays hot in spite of the lawsuits. Anyway, it is a gorgeous, gorgeous clear day. Thank God. Nature's flowers, trees, and sunrises are so beautiful. It must be God's way of making up for most of humanity, which is not. And for all of those of you who are worried about too many Muslims coming into the country, don't worry. They will have absolutely no influence on changing our society. I swear on the Koran. It seems to me America's melting pot seems to be melting on its own. Aside from trying to watch some television this week, besides hockey, and you all know, being from Canada, I'm a hockey junkie, I just could not get by this one terrible commercial that keeps popping up every time I turn on the set. It's this commercial with this middle-aged guy with a gray beard, and he's flanked by two gorgeous females half his age, selling his beer and being called by the announcer the most interesting man in the world. He is not in the least bit interesting until after your sixth beer. But I can tell you, I did see one great infomercial for birth control. It's called the Kardashians. Hey, I did get out this week because I couldn't stay in. And I did it because of a friend of mine. If you saw my Facebook page, I went to an event at what they call the Atomic Museum here in Las Vegas on Flamingo. It was billed as an inside look at Area 51 from insiders. I went primarily because it was moderated by my friend George Knapp. Nobody anywhere in the country is better at this kind of moderating than George, and he was his usual wonderful self. And the other reason was that in spite of all I read, I still know nothing about Area 51, and I still don't. The first two speakers were CIA career men, and after 30 minutes of them talking about how the CIA saved America and the world from the commies, I walked out. I mean, listening to CIA careerists saying they are telling us the truth is like listening to hookers from the Bunny Ranch or Love Ranch telling us they're virgins and that they screw us for free. And speaking of Love Ranch, Lamar Odom, the NBA basketball star, was found unconscious there. And it just goes to prove once again that advertisers lie to us, that what happens in Las Vegas does not really stay in Las Vegas. They're having an election up in Canada today, my native land, as I mentioned, another fake democracy. When I first came down here from Toronto years ago as a comic, I said, I came to America because the communists were trying to overthrow our democracy, but like me, gave up when they couldn't find one. Politicians, I guess as part of career training, have to be liars. We all know George Bush was a liar. Bill Clinton was a liar. Lyndon Johnson was a liar. But to me, the president who told the biggest lie in American history was Abraham Lincoln when he said, we had government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And with that, I can't think of a better introduction than to my first guest. Every year, more and more Americans are leaving the country to live elsewhere. This year finds the highest number of expatriates at nearly 4,000. One of these, I'm really sad to say, was my best friend here in Las Vegas. He was more than a friend. He was a savior for those thousands of you who have thanked me for making the Garrison tapes and lately the last word on the assassination. You should also be thanking him as well as thanking George Knapp. When he saw over 8 years ago, no one except George was helping me to get the word out about this film about Jim Garrison for free. He built a phenomenal site so you and the world could see it for nothing. Without him, we also could have never, ever made the last word on the assassination, which we did a year ago, January, at UNLV. My loss is Thailand's gain. He's a great musician, a genius with a computer, and a great American, even though he just left it. My friend, and now yours, David Lisby. David, thank you so much for being here. And what time is it in Thailand?
Thank you, John. Thanks for the introduction. It's 7:11 a.m. here in Thailand.
Well, thank you so much for being up. Okay, I want you to tell me first, David, how old you are, and a little bit about your life, where you come from, where you were born, your family, your siblings, what kinds of jobs you had, what brought you to Las Vegas, and then what brought you to leave it?
So I'm 44 years old. I grew up in a suburb of California, close to East Los Angeles. I guess it would be considered East Los Angeles, Montebello. I was born actually in Whittier, which is a few cities away from there. And grew up with, I have a little brother who is Down syndrome. He came later. He was the youngest of four of us. I have a brother who's 1 year younger than me, a sister who's 1 year older than me. I was more or less in the middle until Kevin, the youngest who's Down syndrome, was born. And we grew up basically your typical dysfunctional American family, father, everywhere, God knows where. Mother doesn't want to work. Grandparents pretty much raised us. And we hopped around a lot from place to place to place to place to place. And that's what I remember most about my childhood was always moving from one place to another, which wasn't easy because you have to start all over again, make new friends. And when you're a kid, and you don't really realize it when you're a kid, until you get older, you see that it was a very challenging thing to resettle and rebuild your childhood lifestyle. It eventually ended up living with my grandmother on my dad's side, who I love dearly, and my great-grandmother, who was living with us, problem there was growing up in Montebello, because essentially my brother and I, we were two bleach blonde white boys, if you will, and typical American boys with blonde hair, growing up in a predominantly Hispanic town. And so the routine for me was each day getting up, going to school, and ditching gangbangers who wanted to, you know, beat us up. And that's what happened. It was a daily ritual going to school and coming home from school, and mostly coming home from school. It was a challenge every day, getting beat up. And when we would go out to play and go do things, we always had to worry and watch our backs and see if they were there. And the only reason they would pick on us simply was because we were white, we had blonde hair, we stood out. And these were Mexican gangbangers, and most weren't even gangbangers. They just wanted to pick on us because we were white and call us names. So that was very challenging. Growing up was very challenging. But what it had taught me was that, number one, it doesn't matter what people think. Because the way I saw that was, okay, these people don't like me for all the wrong reasons. So who cares what they think? And it taught me to always be aware of what's going on around me, which I think is helpful later in life, to always be aware of the things that are happening around you.
What were some of your early jobs?
So the first thing I remember was we never had money to buy anything. The refrigerator was always scarce. If it wasn't for grandma and grandpa and Nana, we wouldn't have any food. God knows what would have happened. Anyways, the first job I had, I wanted a skateboard, and I really admired Tony Hawk and all these great skateboarders. And so I went to work in a factory, and I was putting paper labels on cans of tuna, sitting at a table with all Mexican immigrants that were in there working, who really treated me well, who really respected me, and they didn't pick on me, and they helped me, and they taught me, and we had little competitions of who can do it the fastest, without making mistakes and having to do it over, and that in itself taught me a lot. But I worked in this little factory, in the back of this little factory, actually, putting these paper labels on tuna cans for several months while I was going to school, high school, and just doing the, or it was middle school, actually. Late middle school, I think, 7th or 8th grade, if I remember. Just doing it. And that in itself taught me that these people, they were of the same race, if you will, as the people that were beating me up and wanting to hurt me for no reason. And these people wanted to help me. And so it was a lesson.
How did you go from wrapping tuna cans to becoming an accomplished guitar player and a computer whiz?
So guitar was one of those things where my father was very into music, not necessarily musical, but listened to a lot of music. Back in those days, the Doors, the band Yes, a lot of different bands, Rush. And I'm from Canada. You should know Rush. In any case, I really admired the way that the electric guitar was able to express emotion. And I was just captivated by it, and I had to know how to do it. I started to play, and my grandfather brought me home a guitar one day as total surprise. And that started that. The rest of it was all somewhere within me. And all I wanted to do was to sit down and play. Later, I found people like Steve Vai and Joe Satriani that just really lit it off for me. And that was that.
How did you get into computers?
Computers, what I looked at, when I saw computers and I saw them coming into the world and the way things worked, I was extremely intrigued. When I was a young boy, my dad, though there was no money and I don't know where he got it, came home with a Commodore computer from Sears, I think he bought it. It was a Tandy, if I remember right. He brought it home, and it was a neat little thing, and I took to it right away. And it came with some games. And I think one was called Buck Rogers or something to that effect. I can't remember exactly. But my brother Jason and some friends like to play the video games. So this book and this game came, you had to put in this cassette tape and this big floppy, and you had to program the game before you could play it. And you had to copy all this stuff out of this book and type it into the keyboard. And then basically, once you got all the code in, the computer would work and the game would work, and then you could play it. Turn off the computer, you had to reprogram it again to play it. Anyways, there was no memory. There was no way for it to remember where you were. In any case, I would do that. And, you know, after 6, 7, 8 times of programming, that just got very interesting to me. But I saw it, and it sparked something in me that was, you know, I knew this was going to be a big deal, you know, changing society.
Well,
later in life.
When I first met you, you looked like the perfect American success story. I mean, you had this great job that you did building these websites for people. Then you ended up at Cox as one of their top technicians. You're an accomplished guitar player. So here you go from this typical poor American background. You're now the American success story. When in that story did you begin to think there was something wrong with the society in which you were living and why you had to move away from it? How long?
Well, that's a big question, but to summarize it, the best way I can summarize it, it actually involves you in a big way. And I've told you this before, that when I came to you to fix your computer the first time, I didn't know you from Sam. But after meeting and talking with you, you told me about what you did, and you told me about the Garrison tapes, and it didn't strike me then. It wasn't until later, when I was working with you and building a website and I was working with that film, that I realized that I had seen it before, that it was very familiar to me when I was working with the video. It was so much so that I knew I had seen it. I just couldn't place it, whether I saw it on YouTube or the internet or wherever it was. But it turned out, I remembered, it was a history teacher I had in continuation high school, of course. Dysfunctional families, you generally end up there. But in any case, this teacher was great because he was all about us learning about the Constitution, the Revolutionary War, and then skipping a whole bunch of history, going to Vietnam and understanding what a, you know, political agenda it was. And we had no business there. And then it was the JFK assassination. And he had us all watch the Garrison tapes. And we did it over the course of a week. He broke it up into segments. And we had quizzes after each time he showed parts of the film. And would quiz us on different aspects of the video and certain questions he would come up with. And his whole thing, he was so animated. And I loved this guy. His name was Vinny. I can't remember his last name for life. But he was the type of guy that goes, "You don't like the studies, you go pound sand." That was the way he was. Right? He was a great guy. But he insisted that we know this. And he insisted that we understood that it was the CIA and that it was the government that killed Kennedy. And he explained it. And as we watched this movie and explained what we were going to see in the chapters and why it was important. In any case, he was so animated and he was so passionate about it. And I liked him so much and looked up to him so much. That really played into me. And it started to make me question so much, although I had already questioned so much. Because when I was younger, I was so interested in extraterrestrials and, you know, the moon and planets and just basically all of the strange things that people would say. In any case, that started to make me question what was going on around me. And so as I started to seek and as I started to question things, I started to find more questions than answers. And so that started to make me very uncomfortable. Then of course 9/11 happened. And while it was happening, it wasn't right. I knew it wasn't right, just like many others. It just didn't seem right. You know, basically a building turning to dust. I mean, the whole thing about it was just crazy. But I knew there was something more. And again, I keep looking and find more questions than answers. So eventually, a few years ago, it came to a point where, well, actually, this was early on, I decided to go on a trip to Australia, which I did. I ended up meeting my wife, who was from Thailand, she was there studying. I was there working with a friend that's doing miscellaneous things, working with computers, and a lot of surfing. But I ended up meeting my wife. They say it's the Australian national surf team. It's a bunch of Australian young guys who live on welfare, all get together with their welfare money, rent an apartment, surf all day, and smoke pot. That's what they do. Australian national surf team. In any case, I was there in this restaurant I went to one night called Chiang Mai Restaurant in the Gold Coast, a place called Surfer's Paradise. Any case, I saw my wife there. I just knew it was one of those moments. In any case, I had to leave Australia eventually. We lost touch with each other. Ironically, I had lost the information in this whole travel process to and from Australia and resettling back in the U.S. when I got back. I had lost some information for an account that I had given her to stay in touch with me. Well, as time passed, my brother and I, we decided to get out of California, mainly because the state tax and the way that the direction that the state was going just was so hard to live in for me. And we moved to Las Vegas. Well, one day I was in Las Vegas and I was trying to remember the access codes to this account that I had. And strangely, one morning I was kind of in and out of sleep and it clicked and I remembered. I got up right away to my computer, turned it on, and logged in, and oddly, who's my wife now, she was online at that time.
Neat.
And there was a ping. She pinged me right away, and she's like, "Hey, how are you?" I was like, "Oh my God!" I told her the whole story. Well, she had gone from Australia back home to Thailand, from Thailand to Boulder, Colorado. She was now living at this point in Boulder, Colorado. I was living in Las Vegas. She was studying for her master's degree at Regis University. She was driving from Boulder, Colorado to Denver every day to go to school in snow and ice and sleet and everything that comes with living in Colorado. And one of the highest cities in the world from going from the Southeast Asian jungle
David,
to one extreme to the other.
David.
And she did it. Well, it turned out.
Hang on a minute. It's a great American international love story. Everybody loves that love story. Okay, now, you ended up getting married, have the most beautiful daughter. She is just, she's movie star quality when she grows up. Okay, your wife worked hard to get out of Thailand to come to America. Now you decide that you're going to leave. How does she feel about that?
Well, of course, her family is here. Everything, her whole life was here. She had the desire to travel abroad to learn, mostly because of education in school. And that's how most Thai people are. They want to get education elsewhere, mainly because the ratings of schools and there's certain aspects to it that are desirable to a lot of your Southeast Asian folk. But she was happy because her grandma, my daughter Pailin, her great-grandmother, Nana, is here and still with us. And her grandmother and mom and aunts, and that family is so big, you just can't imagine how big the family is here. And so for us in America, I had no family. Basically, most of my family, almost all, had deceased or basically disappeared.
While you were living in Las Vegas, you were very, very successful. You were doing well. What was happening in the country that finally tipped you to say, because obviously you'd been thinking about this for years, what was it that tipped you eventually, the thing that you said to yourself, I don't want to raise my daughter in this country. Why didn't you want to raise her here?
So there were several things. It started, I think, back in 2013 when me and my wife were talking about having a baby. And we were trying, actually. And there was an article on TV. I believe it was MSNBC. And if I can remember, it was some reporter, Melissa Perry or something to that effect, Harris Perry, something like that, who did an article. And I think it was even turned out to be a PSA, a public service announcement, where she was claiming that children do not belong to their parents, but were like the responsibility of members of a community. And there was this, I just started to see these certain trends and certain changes. Now, when Obama got elected, I knew there was something very wrong there. And I had followed the Bilderberg group, and I had known that he and Hillary both attended when they met just before the election that year. And there was just too much going on. Then I started to see vaccination, working with drug companies for a portion of my life, working in the medical field at one point, drug research, and working directly with pharmaceutical companies. I learned a lot about how they did their clinical trials. I was working in phase 2 and 3 clinical trials. I learned a lot about them. And I learned basically that the drug companies weren't interested in curing people. They were interested in treating people and keeping customers, just like any business. You don't want to lose a customer. If you cure them, you lose a customer. Keep them dependent, you have one for life. But I started to see a lot of things. It was the way that people were being violated, rights were being violated, how this is slowly chipping away at the Bill of Rights and chipping away at the Constitution. It just made me crazy. It was so hard to wake up every day and see what was going on. And it wasn't just mainstream media, because they weren't reporting half of it. But what I was seeing in alternative news sources and real life stories from people was very frightening. But we were trying to have a baby. And it started to make me more and more uncertain about how it was going to be to raise her in America. People thought I was crazy. Like, what? How could you say that? It's the land of the free, the home of the brave. It's funny that eventually we ended up having a baby. And when that happened, something clicked. And when I held my daughter for the first time, something clicked. And I realized, it was just a very strange feeling. I've always trusted my instincts. I told you earlier how part of growing up helped me develop this sense of always being aware of what's happening around me and peripherally. And so those senses were on ultra high alert. And I tried to see it like, okay, so maybe I'm just overreacting. I just had a baby. I'm being overprotective. And so I analyzed myself. And what I found was that I wasn't being overprotective. I was really seeing things happening around me that were very frightening. And it happened when she was born, when all the nurses came in pushing the hepatitis vaccine, the whooping cough vaccine, how they were pushing formula, and what they were doing at that moment. So here's the time I happened to step out of the room, because my godfather was dying at the same time from stage 4 colon cancer. He was terminal. He actually died two weeks after she was born. And I was his primary caretaker. In any case, I was doing that while I was having a daughter. So I was in those extremes, death and life. Yeah. And I was in the middle of it. In any case, I had stepped out of the room. It turned out that she was vaccinated for a couple. My daughter, everything was hepatitis and whooping cough. And where they got the consent was from my wife, who was just in 8 hours of labor. And I mean, it was very rough labor, very, very rough. It was very painful for her. And it was a natural birth. They wanted to do C-section, but she said no, epidural. In any case, she just gave birth and she was out of it completely. And they got sent consent from my wife, who was in that state of mind. And I was in the state of mind that I was in. And the only person that was there was her mother, who could hardly speak English in that sense, but to understand those terms. But the way that they were pushing it and the statistics they were throwing out, and you can see this pediatric ward was built by a drug company. You could see all their paraphernalia everywhere. Oh, and branding. God. And okay. Yeah. Oh, I'm not even kidding. But I started to realize.
Right now, David, when you look at the past Republican debates and the Democratic debates, what are your thoughts about that? And what are your thoughts about chemtrails?
So the information. Okay. So when I look at these debates, the first thing is that I think that there's a lot of people that are awake, but there's a lot more that need to wake up, because the way that the media manipulates these things, which is very obvious if you're watching them and if you're awake and your mind is open and you can see past it all. And even if you just turn off the volume for a minute and just look at the way that they showcase it, you can see that it's all like a big hoax. It's all like smoke and mirrors. So I don't really have a lot of faith in any of it. The way I look at it is I trust my instincts. I listen to what these people say, and I listen to my instinct meter. But when it comes to chemtrails, you know, that's an interesting thing because, as you remember, I would send you a lot of images from the skies over Las Vegas, which there's a lot of heavy spraying. And I know George knows this. George Knapp knows this. I've sent a lot of images. But the information is out there. And years ago, I came across an article about geoengineering and how, which was even also in Agenda 21, which a lot of people don't know about either. They talk about geoengineering and the use of heavy metals to inject into the upper atmosphere for different purposes to reduce solar radiation. There's all kinds of different theories out there. Never a straight answer, if you will.
When you got to Thailand finally, you were there about 3 weeks, and you sent the greatest picture of clear blue skies, which I...
Well, that was the thing. I remembered as I heard these what they call chemtrails or aerosols in America, I started to see that every day the sky was very hazy, but I always remembered because I was always a sky gazer. As a kid, I was always looking up. I was fascinated at airplanes, so I was always looking at airplanes. And I was just so fascinated by it, the sky and why it was so blue and the airplanes. And so when I started to see these big trails coming out of airplanes, I knew what a contrail was as a kid. We used to go out to the Mojave Desert and watch fighter jets off of Edwards Air Force Base. And we used to do a lot with my dad when we were real young. And so I knew that it wasn't natural what was happening. I knew what a contrail was, and I knew that these weren't contrails. But I started to notice that the skies, and this is about 2005 or 6, maybe 2007, started to see that there was always this kind of perpetual haze. But the skies weren't really ever blue anymore. And it didn't matter what time of the year. It was always that way. And interesting.
Were you concerned? Your daughter is certainly very young, too early to go to school. But with the people that with whom you had to deal with, who supposedly had decent educations here in the United States and in Las Vegas, did you notice that some of the people with whom you dealt weren't as bright as they might have been if they had graduated 40 years ago from the same grade? Were you concerned about the kind of education your daughter might get here or the cost of that education here?
I think it was both. Really, it was both. Because the truth of it is they're just not teaching. It's like there's this whole kind of dumbing down society. And you know, there's plenty of articles and people talking about the dumbing down of American society all over the internet. But it's actually a very real thing. I truly believe that without question. And as far as the debt that students have, I mean, it's just amazing to get out of school, and the amount of debt you have, you're going to be basically a slave for the rest of the majority of your life to pay back these just ridiculous loans that you're getting an education. And when you graduate, you get out and you can't find a job and you can't make money to pay that back. So you end up instantly in debt. In fact, I think when you're born, you have debt because of what the national debt is.
Speaking of money, David, did it cost you a lot of money to leave the country? Was it an exorbitant amount of money? And in Thailand, the money you have, is it enough to get by? Can you work in Thailand?
And what about the answers to those questions?
Okay.
The answers are that people ask me, they say, well, why did you move to Thailand? The answer is because I could, because I can. And that's the easiest answer. As far as expense, the most expensive part was the shipping our belongings. Because, of course, I have many guitars and amplifiers and computers and all these things that I couldn't just put on an airplane with me. Although my most cherished guitars, they did fly with me. The luggage, we had a cat, a dog, two guitars, a baby, a car seat, a stroller, all of our luggage, a grandma, a grandpa. I mean, it was literally when we walked up to check in, and I'm not kidding you, this is no exaggeration. The girl at Korean Airlines, she literally, her jaw dropped when she saw me walking up. And I said, I know. Just, you want to take a break first? Go ahead. You're going to be here a while. And sure enough, because the process we had to go through just for the pets alone was not necessarily expensive, was a big headache and having to get FDA certification. And the truth of the matter is when we got to Thailand, we could have just simply went in and talked to the guy. He said, yeah, okay, go on. There's so many stray dogs and stray cats in Thailand. I'm sure they're not worried about, you know, a dog coming in
Do you have to pay American taxes at all while you live there?
That's a good question. As far as the expense moving here, it wasn't expensive in relative. And as far as cost of living here, we have family, so that makes it easier. And the money that we save, yes, it's going to be enough for a very long time in the way that we live. Now, what was the last question? I'm sorry.
Your question was, do you still have to pay any kind of American taxes being an expatriate?
Yeah. Yes, as a matter of fact, the U.S. government is one state or one country that does require that U.S. citizens, wherever you go, that you must pay taxes on your income, which is a big process, and they make it very convoluted.
If you open a business in Thailand and you're successful, you still have to pay the U.S. Treasury?
That's right. Yes, they will tax me for the rest of my life wherever I go. In fact, if I open a bank account in Thailand, they are required, I think through some kind of corroboration between, I don't know if it's government or banking system, whichever it is, probably both, and the U.S. government, I have to file a U.S. tax form in order to open my bank account.
What if you did not file? Supposing you were a war protester like Chris Hedges or Cindy Sheehan, who said, I'm not paying taxes for you people to go over there and bomb the Middle East. What would happen if you refused to do that?
I'm sure they could probably seize assets in the bank account, or they could, the IRS, you know, God knows what they could do, suspend my passport, cause problems for my visa, because I will always only be a guest in this country. I can never be a citizen. So I must renew my visa every year.
Being married to your wife.
Doesn't matter.
Really?
Doesn't matter. Thailand has very strict immigration rules, unlike the U.S. They have very strict. And even if you're married. Now, my daughter, a different story. Born to heir of my wife, who is Thai citizen. And so that's a different story altogether. But I am merely a husband. I will never be a citizen. And I can never be a citizen. I always be a guest. I must renew my visa, which, you know, as long as I don't do stupid things and live a, you know, a peaceful life in Thailand, then there should be no problems.
So the final question would be, David, are you a lot happier there? Is your wife happier there?
Oh, without question. I thought there was going to be a long adjustment period. I thought there was going to be, I didn't care about me. I cared about my daughter. That was the most important thing. That she grew up with family because of the way my life was. I didn't want her to repeat it. I wanted her to be around family, and big family, be loved. And, you know, there's so many different things, John. When I look up, like you were saying, the blue sky, and I see it every day, and I don't see the aerosols anymore or the spraying anymore. And I see the beautiful, vibrant green, all the different shades of greens in the yards with all the trees. It's so peaceful, and the home's got a big, big pane glass. And so in the morning, I can sit in my recliner and sip my coffee and look out this big glass pane window and see greens.
David, in conclusion, first of all, I am so happy that you're happy. But I'm happier about the fact that you are such a computer whiz. You know how to keep me in touch with you. I miss you guys so much. I really, really appreciate your getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning to do this, because when I posted on Facebook that I was going to have an expatriate on the show, just scores and scores of people were anxious to listen to you. So again, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And give my love to your beautiful wife and your daughter. And I will talk to you on Skype tomorrow, okay?
All right, Johnny. I'll talk to you then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back with the...
You're listening to BBS Radio, If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, he put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you so much to George Knapp for that unsolicited review. You can get it at Amazon. And right now we're going to get to one of the very best journalists in America. He is now happily a regular on this show. People just absolutely love him. He's an award winner. He's won an Emmy. He's done a great documentary that soon will be available with Chris Hedges and Naomi Klein, who love and admire him as much as I do. He puts out the best newsletter every single day called News Vandal. Joe Satilli. Joe, thank you so much for being here. I'm sorry we had a couple of technical problems with the Skype to Thailand. Thank you again for being here. Can I ask you one quick question before you say whatever you want to say?
Please do. It is your. I believe it's your birthday, so I think it's your prerogative.
No, it is not my birthday. My birthday is April 24th.
But then why is Skype misinforming me? Skype is all over the place today.
Yeah, well, they misinform a lot of people. Anyway, quick question. There is a big fan of this show from the Middle East in Arizona who wanted me to ask you about two of the stories that you have in News Vandal about those two great articles you have. And one of them is called Caught on Camera, The Extrajudicial Killing of Palestinians, and the other one about the real costs of making Palestinians pay in Jerusalem. Would you mind addressing that for just a few minutes?
No, we can definitely talk about that. The story about extrajudicial killings, that's in Mondo Weiss. And Mondo Weiss is a left-leaning, pro-two-state solution Israeli publication. It is run by American Jews and Israeli Jews. So this is not Palestinian propaganda. And it's really about the lack of due process during the spate of attacks that have occurred during what is being called the Third Intifada. Now, we just had an attack in Beersheba where a Bedouin attacked Israelis, and it turned into a lynch mob. He was not killed, but an Ethiopian was targeted, an Ethiopian immigrant was targeted and killed. And this is kind of the mob mentality that's going on, but the mob mentality is reflecting the reality of the policy, kind of the stated policy of the Netanyahu government vis-a-vis these rolling attacks, these knifing attacks. Now, we can start getting into whether or not they're justified, whether or not the knifing attacks are, you should condemn them. You know, Bedouin leaders condemned the Bedouin attack that led to the death of the Ethiopian. There has been less condemnation on the part of the Palestinian Authority and the government of Mahmoud Abbas. But what there is in the West Bank and Gaza, what it really attests to is the utter lack of anything that we would call due process. And one of the fascinating things to me about where we are, and I say we because the whole world is involved in this, where we are with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that the two-state solution is never going to happen. I mean, let's just state that. As long as the Israeli government continues under Benjamin Netanyahu, and based on as I look at the people who are in the political arena in Israel, any of his potential successors, you are not going to see a two-state solution. The other story about the real cost of closing down access of Palestinians from East Jerusalem into the rest of Jerusalem, and Palestinians from the West Bank into Israel proper, is that, fascinatingly enough, much of the Israeli economy runs on cheap Palestinian labor. Well, go figure. And one of the costs of this approach of the Netanyahu government towards Palestinians is that it's actually hurting the economy, not just the ability of Palestinians to earn a meager living to feed their families. And I can tell you, in Gaza, Gaza is basically just a walled-off prison where you have unemployment rates as high as like 60%, and they cannot do anything to provide for their own families or feed themselves. But
why does the world, Joe, especially the United States of America, which is always talking about human rights, does this country tolerate that? Why do European countries tolerate that cruelty?
Well, I don't see European countries don't quite tolerate it the way the United States does officially. And you have this BDS movement, which is the movement to do what was done to South Africa during the final days of apartheid. It began in the early 80s, and it began with a lot of musicians who refused to go to Sun City to perform, which was sort of the great resort town in South Africa.
I
remember that. Well, BDS is about divestment of any kind of monies in the Israeli economy. And this is one of sort of the ground zero battle right now that's happening on college campuses around the country, but it's also going to happen more and more in boardrooms. And in Europe, they are more likely to divest. They are more likely to ban the importation of products from Israel as a protest against the occupation. In the United States, look, you have – and what I hate about this story, and this is one of the things that makes it difficult, is – you don't want to get into the realm of being called anti-Semitic or talking about a Jewish conspiracy. But we do say that the oil and gas industry gets a huge amount of subsidies from the United States government, which it probably shouldn't get based on the fact that they earn billions of dollars of profits. Why does the United States have to give them subsidies? But they get the subsidies because they have lobbyists that go to Capitol Hill and secure those subsidies. The same thing is true for the state of Israel, particularly through AIPAC, the American Israeli Public Action Committee, and other organizations that lobby Congress and secure that support. The good example, and let me wrap it up here, is look at what's happening with Marco Rubio. And now that Donald Trump is just completely slapping Jeb Bush around based on the fact that Jeb Bush keeps saying, well, my brother kept us safe during his entire president. Well, you know, and then Trump says, well, there is that thing called 9/11. Jeb Bush has been completely ridiculed into obscurity. Well, the establishment candidate that seems to be sort of touted as rising in his place is Marco Rubio. And what is Marco Rubio's primary selling point for his establishment credentials is that he can raise money from guys like Sheldon Adelson and from pro-Israeli groups because of his belligerence towards both the Islamic State, but specifically towards Iran. There is big money to be made if you are a politician in supporting Israel. It's a twofer, because also there's big money to be made in the military-industrial complex through the continued support of Israel, because as long as Israel continues and the Palestinian problem continues to be a burr in the side of people in the Middle East, there continues to be a need to sell weaponry, not only to the Israelis, but to other powers in the Middle East.
You brought up Trump's comments about his holding Jeb's brother responsible for 9-1-1. Do you really think that Donald Trump believes what he's saying? Do you really think that Donald Trump, for example, if I were to interview Donald Trump, one of the questions I would ask him is, does he really believe the government story about what happened that made the Twin Towers fall? Because it seems to me, if he is questioning George W. Bush, then George W. Bush should have either been impeached for incompetence, or he should have been impeached because he didn't fire those who were incompetent. How much do you think Trump really believes what he's saying?
You know, John, you know, I build things. I'm a builder. That's why I'm going to build a beautiful wall. It's going to be a big wall. I can build walls. I build things. You, have you seen what I've built? I've built the biggest tag at the best properties in the world. Look, John, Donald Trump knows building, and he knows that Building 7 does not make any sense, the collapse of Building 7, right? He knows that. Now, whether or not he's going to be willing to, in an interview with you, say, yeah, something's funny about 9/11. One thing he does know, and this is the sort of the wonderful thing about what he's doing, is he doesn't have to go into sort of the deep politics and the deep conspiracies about 9/11. He could basically say, yeah, it seems to me that you guys got a memo said Bin Laden determined to attack in the United States there in August, and you did nothing about it. And in a sense, that's all you really need to do in this Republican primary to show that this emperor has no clothes. And there are,
you know, I once said, if the emperor has no clothes, you must take the next logical step and arrest him for indecent exposure. But that is absolutely a brilliant observation that you made, because Americans, everybody is so bored beyond belief at the rhetoric that these candidates sprout every 4 years, that if somebody comes along like Trump, who may be an absolute and total jerk. I mean, I read a couple of articles about him, the Rolling Stone article, which is interesting. The one worry I have about Trump, beyond all others, is he looks like a man who will never take advice. And I want him at the nuclear trigger if we have another Cuban Missile Crisis, because at least John Kennedy listened to his brother,
right,
and they didn't start dropping the bombs. But you're right. He doesn't have to really get into detail. He just has to keep doing what he's doing.
Well, and think about this. The American people do not trust their government. All the seeds that were sown, particularly, this is sort of the bitter irony of it for the GOP establishment, they have been playing this tiger by the tail thing with the Tea Party and with this idea that everything that has to do with the government is bad. Government bad. Just keep chanting that, folks. Government bad, and then send in your contributions and vote for our people in the congressional elections. Well, now that's coming back to bite them. And anybody who's associated with the government, which Jeb and his brother W certainly are, now they're being bit by the tiger they've been trying to hold by the tail.
Wow, unbelievable, unbelievable. So do you think that Trump will get the nomination? It seems to me that right now he probably couldn't miss, that he would just coast right in.
Well, John, as much as I despair of my fellow Americans, I cannot believe in a million years that they are going to make Ben Carson the nominee of the Republican Party. So if that's the case, I don't see another alternative for Republicans than Trump. It's not Chris Christie. It's certainly not going to be Jeb Bush, based on particularly his performance in the last 48 hours. You know, Carly Fiorina.
How about Rubio?
Rubio is the guy that scares me. Now, I try to be a journalist, but I will say this, John. Rubio is the scariest candidate. You know, you talk about Trump having access to the nuclear football. The thing about Trump is he's also said America shouldn't be involved in nation building. He said, yeah, I think
yeah, but Bush said that before he invaded Iraq. And
yeah, but who believed Jeb? Who believed W? If you look at W's team, it's Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and the whole neocon team. The thing about Rubio, what is Rubio's campaign slogan? You have it on his, you know, everybody's got a campaign slogan. Jeb is just Jeb with an exclamation point saying, don't remember Bush. But Rubio is a new American century.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Where have we heard that before? Wasn't the Project for a New American Century the group of people that came together and when George W. Bush became president, hijacked his presidency and flew it into the Middle East?
You know, I started the show saying about how politicians lie. And I bet you right now, everyone who likes Donald Trump totally hopes with all their heart that he lies about saying he will run as a Republican. And that if it goes to Rubio and then it goes to Bernie Sanders or Hillary, I think it'll be Joe Biden, that he will then announce he is going to be an independent candidate. And if he is, it'll go into the House of Representatives.
Yeah, and why not? You know, America needs a cliffhanger.
That's exactly right. Joe, I am so glad you're here every week. Honest to God, you are an absolute joy. Sign off, say goodbye, and tell us how they can get your fabulous newsletter.
Well, if you want a shortcut through the gaping maw of daily news, just email me info@newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com. Put sign up in the subject line, and I will email you 5 days a week a compendium of what's going on in the world. You know what? All you have to do is read the headlines, because the way I put the headlines together, it turns into a story itself, and you will know exactly what's going on around you. And it's hard to do in today's environment, because if you just watch CNN, all you hear about is Lamar Odom.
That's right. And when I had Cynthia McKinney on, I used to forward her your News Vandal, and she wrote me back and she said, I just signed on. I'm going to get it on my own. And that's what everybody should do. So I'm going to sign off, Joe, by quoting Ed Murrow the way he used to sign off every newscast. Good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.